Well, I thought I would bring a different lesson to us tonight. See if wouldn't inspire us a little bit. No, the truth is, we often hear people say, "Well, I just need a new brain." Well, of course, literally, they haven't yet perfected the methodology of really transplanting brains. But there's this humorous commercial on television. Perhaps you've seen it. The man's on the telephone, and you hear someone on the telephone says, "Well, do you have the knife?" He said, "Yes, I've got it." He said, "Well, now you're going to put that in between the third and the fourth rib." And the fellow's sitting at his dining room table, and he says, "Well, Doc, shouldn't you be doing this?" And, of course, serious surgery of any kind is best left to the specialist. But when it comes to our understanding about the Bible, there are some things we can do to definitely improve the way our brains work when we're reading the Bible. And so maybe a better title for this one would be "How to Get the Most from Your Bible Study." But it requires us to think differently about reading the Bible and studying the Bible. And so I want to briefly propose to us tonight what I've learned to use over all the years, a step-by-step method. It's not necessary to memorize this, write it down, but I think you'll recognize that it's just common sense. If I've got a project around the house to do, like recently I needed to repair or actually replace the steps that go out into my garage. We live in a house that originally the garage was separated from the house, and then some owner previous to us had built a room in between the house and the garage and joined them together. Well, when you come out of that room, you're right in the garage, but you have to step down, and it's about a 20, 21 inch step down. And so they had just put a single step there. Well, of course, it takes me a while to get around to things. We've lived in that house 11 and a half years, and so finally I'm going to replace that one step with two. So it'd be much easier for Jeanette to step down into the garage whenever she needs to go out there and do the laundry, get to our freezer, other things that we want to do. Well, how am I going to go about this? Well, number one, I've got to decide what it is I'm going to do. And then number two, I have to go get the stuff I need to do it with and then go to work on it. And if I forget anything, and I always do, then I go back to the hardware store and get that. And then I finally get it all put together and put it together, then evaluate it and have Jeanette come out and look at it and make sure it meets her standards, and then we're done. Okay? And so that's how I built two steps going into my garage. But it would be just as true if one of you ladies were going to fix some dish for our Sunday luncheon, not next Sunday night, but a month away. You decide what it is you're going to fix, what are you going to need, you go get it, you start putting it together. If you realize there's something still missing, you go get that, finish the whole thing, and then look at the results. Well, that's what you do with Bible study. That's what you ought to do. Unfortunately, most of us have not been encouraged in the right kind of ways throughout our Christian lives to do that about Bible study. Instead, we've mostly been encouraged to come to church, come to Bible class, listen to what the teacher says, go home. And that makes us neither good students nor qualified, most of the time, equipped to teach other people or share the gospel with other people. That just doesn't accomplish it. And so that same basic kind of procedure that we would use in other things in our life is really what I propose and have done over all the years myself in studying things about the Bible. The first thing I do is always decide what it is I'm trying to do right now. Define my goal or my purpose at this moment. If I'm preparing for the Sunday morning Bible class, in a sense, that goal or purpose has already been defined. We're going to start at the next verse after the one we stopped at last Sunday morning and move forward. So that goal or purpose is defined. If I'm doing a series on Sunday morning, like I am now on the fruit of the Spirit, this morning we did it on gentleness. Well, it's not any secret what next Sunday is going to be for me. My purpose is going to be to study self-control. That's the next one. But in other cases, there might be other things that help define what we're trying to accomplish. But you always start out by defining exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish. Instead of just saying, well, I want to study the Bible, it needs to zero in on something very specific. And then number two, you begin collecting the data. I've gotten used to saying that word because I work with computers so much, but really start collecting together the information I need to achieve that goal. What am I going to need? What am I going to need to do? Where am I going to get that from? How am I going to accomplish that? And then after I've started collecting my information, I take that information I've collected initially and I catalog and arrange it. If you should see the notes that I have that I get up in the pulpit with, over the last number of years in particular, I use regular lined paper, but there's always that margin area off over in the left, and I usually write my initial stuff, at least the bare bones of it, over in that little narrow column on the left-hand side, you know, where the three holes are punched. And then over in the big side, that's where I do my catalog and arranging. It often gets moved around to what seems to me like a logical arrangement or the proper way that I need to approach that. And at that point, that's probably when I start realizing that I'm still missing some stuff. The old thing with Rudyard Kipling, and we had done a couple of weeks ago about my six faithful serving men. When I start saying, okay, who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much, it's actually seven of them. And as I'm looking at the material I've collected together so far in this particular study I'm doing, maybe I've got everything I need except the why. Or maybe I feel like I need to know a little bit more about the how much. And so now I need to go back and go seek out what's still missing. And then at that point, I can put it all together in something that's a cohesive whole for me. And whether I'm going to use that to teach with, or whether it just becomes a part of my personal notes or a notebook or whatever, as I'm studying God's Word, then I find the way to preserve it and apply it. Like I said, I want to tarry on this because I think we're already familiar with this methodology in other areas of life. When you've got a hobby, when you've got a project, when you've got a recipe you're going to cook, if you've got a, you know, if you like to sew, or like Jeanette, she likes to quilt. She just goes through this all the time. Every once in a while, I think maybe she gets stuck on the begin collecting your data part. She goes through this cycle every once in a while for about a month. She just nearly buys out the fabric store, it seems like. And I keep waiting for the next step. When are you going to start putting it together? I can't afford too much more of this. But then she eventually moves on to the next step. And then for a long time, she won't buy anything at all because you've got all this in reserve for whatever she has planned. Well, let's try that out in a way with a simple little project here. We talked about it just briefly in our Bible class this morning where David was passing on to his son Solomon the plans and the resources for the building of the temple and the first great temple in Jerusalem for the Jews to worship God in was built by Solomon. That temple ended up being destroyed. In 587 BC, the Babylonians came in. The people had abandoned God and were worshiping idols and had fallen into immorality and gross social injustice and so forth. And so God had basically abandoned them to the extent that he was going to allow somebody else to overpower them. And so the Babylonians come in, they capture the people, they destroy the city, they destroy the temple. And the people are carried away into captivity in Babylon. Well, after the Babylonians had done what God allowed them to do, then after a long enough period of time, God allowed them to be overthrown by their enemies. The Medo-Persian Empire suddenly rises up. They had been a subservient nation under the Babylonians, but suddenly God allows them to become more powerful and overthrow the Babylonians. And then when the Medo-Persian king comes to the throne, he says, all foreign peoples can go home. And as he was cataloging what all was in the storehouses of the Babylonians that he had overthrown, he discovered all these possessions of the Jews that had come out of their temple. And so he tells them, after a certain period of time, I think maybe there was a petition even by the Jews to him, and he says, you can take these things and take them back for your temple. The only problem was they didn't have a temple. It had been destroyed. And so in the days of Ezra, which is one of the books in our Old Testament, while a Jewish man by the name of Zerubbabel was the governor over the Jewish people. They didn't have a king anymore, but only a governor. In the days of Zerubbabel and Ezra, they started rebuilding the temple. The oldest members of the community could still remember when they were children what the original temple of Solomon looked like. And when they saw the new one rising, even though they were glad on the one hand that at least they were once more going to have a place where the sacrifices could be made and where they could gather round that place and worship and honor God. On the other hand, this what was being built now was nothing like the original in terms of the glory of it, the magnificence of it. And they openly wept as they saw it. But nevertheless, that temple was completed, and it continued to be used by the Jews from about 516 B.C. down to about 20 B.C. 500 years they used this inferior, in their own mind, temple. And at that time, the king that was over them, or the king that had been put over them by the Romans, Herod, decides as one of his great building projects, along with all the other magnificent ones he had, he decided he was going to completely rebuild the temple. And it was his determination to make it more magnificent than the one that Solomon had built. And so in about 19 B.C., something like that, the temple started being rebuilt. Now, they had to do that while it was being used. And so it's like anything, when you're trying to refurbish something and expand it while it's being used, you have to be kind of careful. And he tried to show respect for the Jewish people, in so much so that in the areas where only priests could go in the temple, he even took 1,000 of the priests and trained them to be carpenters and stonemasons so they could do the work in there instead of the regular stonemasons and carpenters they would have used otherwise in the other areas. And the construction begins. And when Jesus is born, his parents take him into the temple when he's just the infant he is. We read about it in, you know, the first chapter of Luke. They actually take him into the temple, and even though it was already taking great shape, because they had already been doing it by that time for 20 years, nevertheless, it wasn't complete. And when he is age 12 and he goes up with his parents to the temple and they lose track of him and find him 3 days later, the temple's still being refurbished. And when he begins his ministry at age 30 and is baptized by John the Baptizer and goes to the temple the first time, as this new young rabbi who's starting to make sort of waves in the Jewish religion, they're still refurbishing and it's still going on. By that time, Herod's long dead. But the work continues. He'd already set aside the workers. He'd already set aside the funds. He'd already set aside the materials. And it continues. In fact, it's not finished until 64 A.D. From 20 B.C. or 19 B.C. to 64 A.D., more than 80 years it took to refurbish it. But it was magnificent. It was magnificent. And 6 years later, the Romans destroyed every bit of it. And therefore, when we talk about the temple that Jesus knew, we have to talk about something we can't see, something that isn't there anymore. We can't go over there and take a tour of it. In fact, what is left of just the huge platform or foundation upon which it was built, much of it we can't even get up onto. The Muslims now control that particular part of Jerusalem, and they have built on top of that platform a mosque in one area, and in another area they've built a huge museum and a memorial called the Dome of the Rock. And that's sacred to them. Now, that area is also considered sacred in at least some sense, both Christians and Jews, but that's tough. The Muslims control it. And so no archaeological digs go on there, no scientific exploration, no historical research is allowed because it's sacred to those people. So how do we know more? How can we find out more about the temple that Jesus knew? And so that's sort of what I've set out as the goal or the purpose of this particular little study. And we're not going to finish this by any means tonight, but I just wanted you to see and work together with me on how this is going to happen. So we start out with a goal. What was the Jewish temple like in Jesus' time? He knew it well. We know very little. All right? So how are we going to start collecting the information about that? Well, the first thing I always want to do when I'm studying a Bible subject, even if I know more information might be available somewhere else, the first thing I always want to do is find out what the Bible says about it. Start there. And so that's what we do. Now, the best way to do that with a subject like the temple in Jesus' time is actually go read that part of the Bible where that is being mentioned. That's going to pretty much limit us, isn't it, to the Gospels. It's not going to be the Old Testament, because that's not the temple Jesus knew. After we get past about the book of Acts, the temple that Jesus knew is scarcely even mentioned in the epistles and all that. Now, some other temples are mentioned, temples to God, you know, idols, and even how the church is a temple of God and so forth. But just the temple that Jesus knew. So, you know, we're probably going to be pretty much, I think I stepped myself backwards here. Let's see. You know, collect the information. What does the Bible say? And so the place to start, if we want to see what the Bible says, is either to sit down and read Matthew through John and Acts. And I recommend that still. But sort of a little bit of a shortcut when you're doing something very specific like the temple is to use what's called a concordance. A concordance is a study book. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago. Here's one nice small pocket-sized edition that lists, in this case, it's called an exhaustive concordance because that means it lists every place, every word appears in the Bible. Now, these are often keyed to different translations because there are some words in the Bible that are translated differently in different translations, and so the listings would be a little different. Now, the word temple is one you don't have much trouble with. It's translated by the word temple in the New Testament in I guess, every translation I know. King James, New American Standard, American Standard, NIV, Revised Standard. But the only one that it might not be done it in is one that's not really a translation at all. Some of the paraphrases might use some other word. But we would use a Strong's Concordance, and we would simply look up the place where it lists all the places where the word temple appears. And then we would zero in on the part that starts with Matthew and goes through Acts. And so what I've done is I've actually made a copy of that page out of the concordance for all of us. And for some of you, this is very familiar. And maybe for others, you haven't had much opportunity to do this before. When you see it, on the one hand, I will apologize that the print's so small.
I was supposed to read it.
Well, unfortunately, that is the struggle. Sometimes in order to make the book as small as it is, they made the print smaller. There are some reprints of them that are coming out now. They're starting to realize that not everybody has 20/20 vision, even with glasses. And so they do have some that are a little bit larger print. But when you look at this with me, upper left, first column, temple, it says. And it starts in the Old Testament with 1 Samuel, and you can see them listed. So we're only going to come down near the bottom of the first column before we start hitting the book of Matthew. They're in order by the books of the Bible. And there we see Matthew chapter 4, verse 5 is the first place in the New Testament where the word temple appears. And they don't even give you the whole verse. They just give you a few words, enough so you can sort of recognize what it says. And so it says, him on a pinnacle of the T. The T standing for temple. But now I want to point out one more thing to you. Off to the right of Matthew 4 and verse 5 is a number. 2411. Scholars 100 years ago started settling on a number system for the words in the Greek or in the Hebrew. And so what that number there tells us is in that particular verse, Matthew 4 verse 5, the Greek word for temple is word number 2411 in this number system. I may not think that's worth much to you right now, but I'm telling you that. In fact, if you look on down below it, you see lots more times where 2411 appears. And then suddenly you notice along about Matthew 23, you start hitting some 3485s. And then you go back to 2411, then 3485, 2411, 3485. And what we're seeing there is that for all intents and purposes in the New Testament, there are two words in the Greek language that are both translated by the one English word temple. And they're words number 2411 and word number 3485. We'll just store that temporarily. As I said, we're specifically going to just be looking at Matthew through Acts. And what I do is now that I've found out where the passages are that mention the temple in this part of the Bible, I start turning to every one of those verses and reading it. I didn't say this was going to be easy. I'm just saying, you know, if we're studying the Bible, this is not just casual stuff. This is actually trying to learn for ourselves. You could just wait till some Sunday morning when I preached on it or some Sunday night like tonight. But you can do this yourself. And so I would start with Matthew 4 and verse 5, and I would read what it said, and I would think to myself, does this verse contribute anything to my understanding about the temple in Jesus' day? And so I turned there, and it says, then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. Well, it tells me one thing, that the temple has something called a pinnacle. Or if you read in the NIV, it actually says to the highest point of the temple. Because that's what pinnacle means. The highest point. Whether it's actually pointed or not. So the temple has some place that's a very high point on it. As I look down through these others, and as I read them, I will discover that some of them just mention the temple, but maybe don't really tell us anything about it. And others contribute other things, but then I start making a list. You know, I may eventually end up breaking the list down into some of the physical attributes of the temple and another list about what it says that people did in the temple and so forth. And I'm just going to read all these scriptures. I'm not going to do that for you tonight, but I am going to read some of them to you. And you'll see how this is applicable. Look, for example, in Matthew chapter 21, that's about the fourth listing down. In Matthew chapter 21, the two before there in Matthew 12 didn't seem to me to add very much to my knowledge. But when I get to Matthew 21, it says in verse 12, Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. So what were they doing at the temple? They were selling sacrificial animals. They were, does it mention there that they were changing money for people and so forth? So one of the things that happened at the temple, something Jesus was very upset about, was that they had turned a part of the temple into a kind of marketplace. And then it says in verse 14, the blind and the lame came to him at the temple and he healed them. So something else that happened in the temple is that Jesus healed people there. It's not the only place he healed them, but he definitely healed them there. And we even can tell that they were allowed to come there or they wouldn't have been present. And it said, but when the chief priests and the teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple area, oh, they allow children there too. Hosanna to the Son of David. They were indignant. Do you hear what these children are saying? They asked him. Yes, replied Jesus. Have you never read that from the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise? And he left them and went out of the city to Bethany where he spent the night. And so we actually gathered several little tidbits there of information about the temple. That they had turned a part of it into a market. And Jesus was very upset about that. He said it's supposed to be a house of prayer. That's even a bit of information there. But they were not only making a marketplace, it was a marketplace where people were actually being taken advantage of. That makes me think either the price of the animals that were being sold and the birds that were being sold were way too high, or when they were exchanging money, it was an exorbitant exchange rate. Something is going on where Jesus calls it robbery. But then he also is allowed to heal people there, and even children are there in the temple. And they are praising Jesus, and the authorities try to get Jesus to make them stop. And instead, he commends them rather than telling them to stop. All right. Then if we go down a couple of chapters and we see that on our sheet, actually, I guess on down in chapter 21, verse 23, it says, Jesus entered the temple, and while he was teaching, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him. So here's something else he did there. He taught. So that adds a little bit to my information. I'm going to move on over to chapter 23 of Matthew. This is that chapter in Jesus' teaching where it's often called the Woe Unto You Scribes and Pharisees chapter. Because he's really getting after these men because of their hypocritical ways. And as he's doing that, he gets to a certain point where he talks about the temple. And so he says in Matthew 23:16, Woe to you blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. We may have trouble understanding exactly what the issue was here, but it seems that when they would give their word that something was true, maybe they made a pledge to somebody else, or they actually made an oath that something that they said that they would perform or that was truth, they apparently had this little agreement among themselves that if they swore by the temple that it was true or that they would do it, they really weren't obligated to do it. But if they swore by the gold that was on the temple, then they were obligated. Well, first of all, it tells us there was gold on the temple, you know, just for our immediate subject. And we'd like to spend some time talking about what the whole problem was here. Of course, the first problem was that their word wasn't worth anything. Their yes wasn't yes and their no wasn't no. They felt like they had to swear even to get people to trust them. And then no wonder people wouldn't trust them, because they had left themselves a loophole to get out of it. Jesus condemns them for that. But remember when we made the little note that when we get to a certain point, we suddenly see a different word being used for the temple? This is the first place we find that other word being used, 3485. Well, I'm not going to leave you in suspense about what 2411 and 3485 are. The second page of your handout is out of Vine's Expository Dictionary. An expository dictionary is where it tells us what the English meaning of those Greek words are, or the English meaning of the Hebrew words if it's one keyed to the Old Testament. And there, under temple, you'll see number one, and it has the word hieron. And then it even shows us the Greek characters, and then what's the very next thing after that? 2411. So it's letting us know that everywhere back over here in the concordance that it says 2411 is used, it's this Greek word hieron. And then he goes on to tell us what it means in some of the passages where it's used in the New Testament. And he says, literally, the word means sacred. It is used as a noun to denote a sacred place, a temple. And so over in the latter part of Acts, it's actually used to describe the temple of Diana. In Matthew 11:11, of course, the one in Jerusalem that we're talking about. And he said it signified the entire building with its precincts, or its whole grounds, or some part thereof. And he says that is distinct from the naos. If you drop down to word number two, just in the next paragraph, there's number two, naos, 3485. And he says of naos that it is a shrine or sanctuary. If it was talking about an idol, it was a place where the idol itself was actually kept. Among the Jews, it was a sanctuary in the temple, that area into which only the priest could lawfully enter. And so when we're reading all these places in the New Testament where the word temple is used, in some places they're using the word heron, which meant the sacred area. And so that could apply to any part of the temple. It could apply to the outer courts, the porches, the pinnacle. That would all be a part of the heron. But if we ever see them using that other word for temple, naos, they're always talking about that central building right in the middle of it all that only the priest could go into that contained the holy place and the most holy place. Nothing else. It's never used for anything else when it's talking about the Jewish temple but that when it's the word naos. Now, I hope that's not more than you wanted to know, because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John chose which one of those two words they wanted to use in each of the places they used it because they thought it was important. So we ought to think so too. When we get here in Matthew 23, and in verse 16, when it says, "Woe to you blind guides, if anyone swears by the temple," our concordance says that's the naos word. That's the sanctuary word. So literally Jesus would say, if one of you swears by the sanctuary, the holy place, you say that's okay, you're not bound. But if you swear by the gold that's on the sanctuary, the holy place, then you're bound. The gold wasn't everywhere all over the whole temple area. The gold was only on the sanctuary, as it turns out. But as he goes on, he says, "You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it." Turns out that just out in front of the naos, the sanctuary part of the temple, was an altar. It was the altar where the burnt offerings were made. It was the altar where the sin sacrifices were made. And apparently they, just like they had done with the sacred place itself, they had started to swear by the altar and didn't feel obligated to keep their word when they swore by it. But if they swore by the sacrifice on the altar, then they felt like they had to keep it. This kind of legalistic convoluting so they could actually get around doing what was right. That was representative of them. But after he finishes this, it says in Matthew 24 and verse 1, Jesus left the temple. That's back to the broader word for temple. Why didn't Jesus go into the naos? No, if we were to read ahead, you would discover it never says that Jesus went into the naos. Why didn't he ever go into the naos? He wasn't a priest. He wasn't a Levite. He wouldn't be allowed, and he wouldn't have tried. He had that much respect for God's word. I think if we were to jump ahead to Hebrews, we would discover that there, when he went into heaven, he went into the naos. He's a priest there. In heaven, Jesus is the high priest. So he can go into the sacred place, not just into the broad courts. Well, in Matthew 26:55, when the crowd comes out to arrest Jesus in the garden that night, he said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me." Again, referring to the fact that Jesus taught in the temple courts. At his trial in Matthew 26 and verse 60, "Finally two came forward and declared, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Now they, first of all, are misquoting Jesus. He didn't say he would destroy the temple. He said if they destroyed the temple, he would rebuild it in 3 days. They're misquoting him to having said that he would destroy the temple, but which temple is he talking about? The naos. Of course, literally he was talking about the temple of his body, but the word that's used here by these fellows is actually the sanctuary. That was to them their most sacred part, you know, and so they're accusing Jesus of saying he would destroy the holy place. is what they're accusing him of. In Matthew chapter 27, Jesus has gone through his trial, and he's now been condemned, and he's going to be sent off to Pilate to get the formal sentencing. And Judas, seeing what has happened, filled with great regret at what has happened, whatever he thought would have happened, I don't know, but this is what has happened. And he's got what? These 30 pieces of silver we talked about last week in his hands for having sold Jesus out. And it says in Matthew 27 and 3, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priest and the elders. And he said, I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood. So he tries to give them back the 30 coins, and they won't take it. They say to him, what is that to us? That's your responsibility. You know what he does with the money? So Judas threw the money into the naos and left. He actually met with them, or perhaps after he met with them, he went as close as any Jewish man was allowed to get to the temple, which was close enough to do what he's about to do. And he takes those 30 pieces of silver and he throws it through the front door into the holy place and leaves and kills himself. He didn't just walk to the edge of the temple precincts and just toss it out there in the whole precinct area. He actually went into the place where he could throw it into the naos. So see, again, Matthew used the word he wanted to use, so we would understand where it was Judas threw the money. It wasn't into the bigger overall temple area, but specifically into the holy place. And Jewish men who were in right standing in the Jewish community were allowed to get close enough. They couldn't go in, but they could get within about 15 or 20 feet of it, of the steps that led up and into the front door. And that was close enough for him to do what he did. Okay, in verse 51 of Matthew 27, Jesus is condemned by Pilate. He's marched out with two other men and he's crucified on Calvary. And as he's hanging there on the cross, he's there from about the ninth hour of the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, about 6 hours on the cross. And then in verse 50, and when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. He dies. And at that moment, the curtain of the naos, the sanctuary, was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split and the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. And they came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many witnesses or people. Now we find out that this sacred place has, in the naos, there's a curtain in there. Often in the Old Testament, it was just referred to as the veil of the temple. There's a huge curtain. It actually was there. It separated the holy place from the most holy place. It was like 5 layers thick, a very thick woven material. It was something like 60 feet high. That is quite a drape or a curtain. 30 feet wide, woven out of ornate materials with gold thread woven all through it. And no one was ever, ever, ever allowed to pull that back because that would reveal the entrance into the most holy place. And yet suddenly the whole thing tears open all on its own. Own in the sense that no man did that. And there must have been a mad scramble by the priest at that point to do what they can to get it pulled back closed so neither they or anyone else could see into the most holy place. And yet God was using that symbolism to say that at that moment Jesus had just left the holy place in heaven and gone into the most holy place to offer his own blood as a sacrifice for the sins of the people. That's what the priest on earth did once a year. He went behind that curtain with blood and poured it out before the ark, which represented the throne of God. He poured it out for his own sins. Then he came back out and sacrifice was made for the sins of the people. Then he took the blood and he went back in there a second time. And then he poured it out for the people. Jesus just did it in heaven. And God gave formal notice at that moment that that's what had happened by tearing that curtain on earth wide open. Get this gist of what's going on here. You read the scriptures. You try to gather together what's the information being given to us. So far, we've just got through Matthew. But already, we've heard that in the temple that they had this bigger temple area, but in the middle of it, there was a sanctuary. This sanctuary had gold on it. We know that much. It had some way for it to get into it because Judas threw the money in there. It had a curtain in it because it's torn in two. We hear that Jesus out in the larger temple area, he taught people. He healed people. He drove the people out of that marketplace that they had set up there. We're starting to get at least something of a description from the gospel writers of what the temple was like. But if you were to continue with Mark and then Luke and then John and the first several chapters of Acts where the temple is mentioned several times, you read all of those and collected all that information. After you collected it all, I think you would discover something. If you were to take a blank white piece of paper and a pencil and try to draw a picture of what the temple looked like from all the information you've just collected, you couldn't do it. There's not enough information there. Why didn't they tell us more about it? Matthew knew exactly what it looked like. The people he was writing to start with, knew exactly what it looked like. Same is true of Mark. I can't quite say for sure that that'd be true of Luke, because he writes to someone called Theophilus, and the likelihood is that Theophilus had probably never been to Jerusalem and never seen it. But it didn't suit his purpose to tell us any more than he does about it. John, when he writes, same thing. He's a Jew. He grew up there. He knew what it looked like. What I'm just saying is that when we start our study of something like this, we start out by collecting the information we can out of the Bible. Then we take note of anything special, like we notice those two different words that were used for the temple, and just recognize that the authors used the word they wanted to use in each place. So then we try to discover why. And I think it's pretty obvious in most of the cases why in one place they'd use the word heron, just meaning the sacred area, and in other times used the word for sanctuary because they were talking about the central building where the most sacred things took place. Okay, shut that down. What we'll try to do next week is see, you know, not continue going through the rest of the New Testament. You can do that on your own. I hope you would avail yourself of that opportunity. But what we want to do next week then is to look to see, well, where can we find more information about the temple if we don't have enough to satisfy our curiosity just in the scriptures themselves? How do we get ourselves more nearly in the same position those early Christians were in who lived in Judea and Galilee? The very first Christians, where we turn to Bible dictionaries and Bible background books, where they have access to other materials we don't otherwise have access to. We end up discovering there was actually a man who lived during that period of time who wrote a book and described what the temple looked like. And he did say it was this long and this high and this deep. He actually said all that stuff. You might have heard his name before. He was a man called Josephus, and his books still exist. He is our number one resource for knowing what it looked like in Jesus' time, but not the only one. Well, Mark has an invitation song for us.